Welcome to Vermont Favorites, a production of WBTV LP 99.3 FM Burlington. I'm Adam Rabin. Each week I talk with musicians, artists, performers, and creators about their unique journeys and what they love about living in Vermont. My guest today is the lead singer of Ruff Francis. Say hello to Bobby Hackney Jr. How's it going?
Hey, how you doing?
Good, good. So you are the lead singer. I know you're the lead singer. I shouldn't be asking you if you're the lead singer of Ruff Francis, because I know you pretty well. Well, let's start off right there with Ruff Francis, and then we'll talk about how you got there. What's the latest with the band? What can you tell us about what's going on? And you have an album coming up. Is that right?
Yeah, yeah. We did a soft release of our new record. It's titled MSP3 Counterattack. Yeah, we did a release on Record Store Day. The vinyl came out. We didn't really plan for the Record Store Day soft release, but the timing of the vinyl came out before it came out before Record Store Day, so we decided to take advantage of that, and that went really well because people didn't know about the album until we told them it was available on Record Store Day.
Also, like a last minute.
Yeah, so last minute. It was kind of like a last minute Easter egg hunt type thing, nice. Which was really cool and fun for all of us. And
yeah. Well, you guys have had the album's been more or less done for a while, but yeah, it just took you a while to get the album.
Yeah, it took a little while to get to the finish line.
Yeah. I've been there, believe me. Well, tell me about the album first. Like, what's MSP, remind me what that stands
MSP
for.
MSP3. So MSP stands for Maximum Soul Power.
Right on.
And that's actually the name of our first record.
Ah.
And it turned into this thing that we just always, it's kind of, now it's like kind of a joke, an inside joke with the band. Like we're the only ones that really think it's funny, but so we did Maximum Soul Power. That was our first album. And yeah. Then we wrote a song later we called it MSP2 for some reason.
Gotcha.
Cause we didn't have a good name for the song. So we were like, yeah, let's call it MSP2 for now. Whatever. We'll change the name later.
And you never
And of
do.
Course, the name stuck. Because I feel like so many bands go through that. Like, they'll give their songs the dumbest names.
Yep.
And you just never... It's like, this is like the placeholder name. And then you just never give it the real name.
And that's how Phil Collins created Sussudio.
Yes, exactly. So it just stayed MSP2, the song. And yeah. That became a single. And then we're like, hey,
let's
might as well keep
album.
This going. And let's do our second album. We'll really confuse people. Our second album will be called MSP3 Counterattack. And so people are like, what is MSP2? That's just a song. And then MSP1 is an album. So like people are like, what the?
Good, good, good. Keep them on their toes.
Keep them on their toes.
But it's still your definite sound, right?
Yes.
It's a very much a musical continuation from where you guys were.
Yes, yes. I feel like the record, our latest, is definitely sounds more like Ruff Francis because when we recorded MSP1, the first record, we were very fresh and coming into our own, and we were still trying to find our sound because there was like a lot of other things that we were influenced by, and we wanted to incorporate all of those influences, but. At the same time, it was really, really hard to find that balance and like get our sound. And I feel like with this latest record, it's definitely, you know, how we want to sound, how we want to be presented. And we're just really happy with how it came out.
Yeah. Well, cool. What are those? Like, tell me about the first album. We'll go back a little bit. What were those influences that were pulling you along at the beginning?
Well, at the beginning, I mean, before we started writing our own songs, we were doing all the Death Tunes live, and it was primarily covers. And then when we started writing our own stuff, a lot of it was influenced by Death. And then, you know, we also grabbed a lot of Death's influences, like The Who and The Stooges, stuff like that.
But
you know, along with that, like the production of the record was a little different than like we recorded at this place called Signal Kitchen at the time.
Yeah.
And Signal Kitchen was just barely getting started.
Right.
And they were just a recording studio. This is before they had like all their other
the venue.
Yeah. Before they were a venue. So they were just a recording studio. And like we were like an early artist that was like working with them. They only worked with a couple artists before us. And so, you know, it was like a lot of trial and error on both sides, on our side, on their side.
Okay, well, that's cool that they were,
yeah,
they had that room to breathe.
Totally, totally.
You didn't feel like you were like under the gun.
Yeah, so like, but with that, it's kind of, there was like so much open space, and it was like kind of open-ended that, you know, we felt like we didn't really get the sounds that we really wanted to get. I mean, it turned out great for what we had to work with.
Right.
But, you know, it was our first album, and I feel like any band's first album is kind of the one where it's like, oh man, you know, I wish I could have gone back and done this. But that's only from the musician's standpoint.
And you re-released it, is that right?
Yeah, we re-released it. And the cool thing is, I mean, I it's great because like I some of my favorite albums, like for example the Velvet Underground Andy Warhol album.
Yeah.
I heard that like the drummer, what's her name, Mo Tucker?
Tucker, yeah.
Mo Tucker. She says she hates that recording. She hates the drums on it. She despises that recording. But it's like this legendary record.
It is, yeah.
So it's like sometimes it doesn't matter what the musician thinks. If the listener or the public sees it or likes it a certain way, like you just have to, you know, let all those hang-ups go.
And yeah, I've definitely heard you know, some albums that have been remixed over the years,
yeah,
and sometimes for better, sometimes for worse, and you can tell what the beef was that the artist had with it.
Yeah,
and it's fun to read about. I can think of a few different ones where like it was just the circumstances behind the album were just not quite
exactly
optimal.
Sometimes it's that.
Yeah,
yeah, and it's just like it brings up bad memories or whatever. But
yeah, so you went back and you guys remixed it.
We didn't remix it. I mean, we did the whole, the mixing progress.
You did the whole album from the top.
Yeah. Right? And you're still talking about the first album.
The first one.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. We, you know, the mixing process took a long time as well.
Yeah.
And we got it to a place where we were happy with it and we released it and it did pretty well. Mm-hmm. It was received well, but with this new record, we, went in. Before we even started tracking, we make sure we had all the tones right and
made sure
everything was like dialed in the way we wanted.
And you're doing it at your own studio now.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
That's a key.
Yeah, that's the key.
That's exactly what I did, you know, with my band's first and then second album. The first album we recorded at Egan. We did all the basic tracks over at Egan. And then for the second one, we were just like, let's just invest the money and, you know, and then we can really take our time with it. And
that's what it takes. It takes a lot of time to get that sound right. Whatever sound you're trying to get, sometimes it takes a little while to capture it on a recording.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you guys in the band are the ones that run it. I mean, Steve.
Yeah, Steve and Urian were the main engineers for this record, for the latest record.
So we need to be full disclosure for our listeners.
Yes.
That Urian is your
brother?
Brother and Steve is my brother-in-law.
Full disclosures. Yep.
Right.
Yep.
But yeah, I love what you guys came up with there. The sound, from what I've heard so far, the length of time you're talking about getting the tones right and getting the sounds right. You know, how long have you guys been working on this and what's it's, been well, the it, process?
Yeah. Well, it was funny because the album was actually tracked a while ago. Like we tracked it almost 2 years ago and the performances were what we wanted, everything. But then the mixing thing took a little longer than we thought. And then there's like some other things we had to revisit with the recording, but you know, we took our time cause we just wanted to like have something that we were really proud of at the end. Mm. And sometimes, you know, you can't rush something. If you want something to be exactly how you want it. I mean, I'm not even saying it's exactly how we want it, but like just, you know, something that we were like stoked on, it takes a little time to get there. And, you know, once we were like, okay, we're done. We can do this.
Yeah.
It was nice. It was a good feeling to just be like, yep, we're all done.
I'll bet.
Send it out. Send it away.
So you're getting it pressed. You're getting the vinyl. Well, you did the vinyl
press. Yeah, the vinyl has been pressed at Burlington Record Plant.
Yep.
We just started pre-orders.
And How long is it? Like, what's on the album? What's the, is there like a, when you call it MSP3, it sounds like some kind of like concept album. Like,
yeah, yeah.
There's some
yeah.
kind of like unifying message behind it. But if there is one, what do you,
there
do you
definitely is one for this one. Cause like we, you know, MSP3 Counterattack, there's a few songs on the record that touch on like what's going on socially in this country. And, there's a lot of, you know, things that like I've just been wanting to get off my chest lyrically, and yeah. that's in there.
Such as
like, you know, just like human rights issues, like mm-hmm. A lot of my messages like echo what the Black Lives Matter movement is trying to, you know, convey to the masses. Right. So like a lot of stuff, because a lot of these songs were written when, you know, the Ferguson thing happened, or like the Trayvon Martin thing, yeah. you know? So like we wanted to get like a little more political with some of the lyrics. And then there's also, you know, some other tunes on there that are just like, you know, about some other stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's, so, you gotta yeah. mix it up. You can't yeah. be all heavy all the time.
Yeah. Yeah. There's some serious songs, and there's like some lighter songs, and you know, there's a little bit of humor, you know.
Well, you got it.
A little
yeah.
bit of everything.
Yeah, I often life, think, you know? Yeah, humor's got to, exactly, it's got to be a part of life. I think about humor because I know I use humor in my songs from time to time. And there's this tendency for people to dismiss stuff that's humorous. But then I think about, you know, if you're talking with someone and you're having like a conversation and you say 10 things and they say 10 things back to you, chances are a few of those things are going to be humorous.
Yeah,
of course. A few of them are going to be serious, and a yep. few of them are going to be like, just kind of nebulous, kind of questioning things. So why wouldn't a 10-song album reflect, you know, how we are as people and have those yeah. same moments?
Yeah, and I like to package up like really heavy concepts and humorous, like just like make it humorous. It's like, because like that's what makes it digestible, is like
absolutely
the humor. It, like, you can swallow it, and then you're like, whoa. Yeah. And then you're like, oh, wow.
What did I
that
just
was also
eat?
Funny, but it was also sad and true.
Yeah, that really is. I love that stuff. I mean, that's yeah. what I'm always going for, is like, yeah. how can I be you know, because you could think of like something like, you know, like a Weird Al song, which is just goofy for the sake of goofy, and you need yeah. that. But then there's some people who will say, how can I be substantial, but not, you know, so
yeah.
heavy
yeah.
and serious. So the you're talking about the Black Lives Matter, the Trayvon Martin incident, and how have you guys been received? Do you feel that Ruff Francis has a role, I don't want to say a role or an obligation, but a unique opportunity to address issues like that?
Yeah, I think we do, because I feel like, you know, especially in Burlington, you know, there's not many bands like us, mm-hmm. you know, that are like, it's primarily, you know, like a African-American band playing punk.
Yeah.
And well, primarily African American, there's, you know,
yeah.
and you know, like, we have something to say, and our message, and it's like, you know, our music is on the louder side.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's very like, for me, it's very, cathartic, because, you know, I have a lot of, like, you know, anger and energy about, like, when I hear about these things, like, I just want to yell, you know, and it's yeah. great that I get to do it in front of a band. And like, you know, I always like, I'm like, man, why aren't there more bands that are like speaking out and saying these things? And, but then I'm like, oh yeah, we're a band that does these things. So we're just pretty much being the band that we, like, would want to see, like, you know,
was seeing, that's interesting, because band that you want to see, because, you know, we all want to see the music that tends to attract most people is the music that we identify with, you
yeah.
know, on some personal level.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking about how your band started. You were talking about death, which is your, tell me if I get this wrong, your uncles and your dad, or
yep.
is it? Okay. That's I was it. Right. So to see them, I mean, it doesn't get much more relatable than your actual relations
yeah.
doing that. And that must have been like right back from the beginning. That was that the moment that you got interested in music, or were you always
Oh, all of us were always interested in music, like earlier on, even before we found out about death. So our dad and uncles, or our dad and uncle Dennis, were in this band Lamb's Bread. It's a reggae band.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, we always grew up around music. And
they were doing Lamb's Bread.
Yeah, we just knew them as reggae guys. And that's how we got into music. And that's how we got into playing music, because we just saw them. And, you know, once we, got into our own styles of music and hanging out with our own friends and starting our own bands, we all gravitated towards punk and rock and stuff like that.
Even before knowing about death.
Even before. And it's like, very uncommon for black kids to be into that to begin with,
mm-hmm.
especially, around here. And then we just all got into punk, which is kind of weird. And once we started to live the punk lifestyle and embrace that, that's when we were we didn't even know we were priming ourselves for this huge story, the family story, without even knowing it. And then once we find out about that, we're like, oh, okay. So we actually knew exactly what to do. And
that's interesting that you knew exactly what to do.
Yeah, it was the right time. Yeah. I was in my early 30s. I feel like if I would have found out about death when I was any younger, probably wouldn't know what to do.
Interesting. Because usually, whenever you think of punk, you wouldn't think of someone in their 30s already starting up a punk band.
I know, yeah. Because there's a lot of bands I didn't even know about yet when I was younger. Like, I didn't know the MC5 or the Stooges yet. There was a bunch of bands that, I didn't get into some of those bands until I was, 22 or, 25.
Huh.
So I feel like even if I would have heard it when I was a little younger, I still wouldn't really understand the importance of it.
Gotcha.
Know?
Yeah, I guess that's something that comes with age.
Yeah, it does come with age.
Of history and where, especially punk, where punk sits in the history of music. And, if you think about where punk started in England and why it was started in England, mm-hmm. and, it was that downtrodden, the oppressed, working class and lower. And that's kind of where... if I understand it correctly, where death was coming from.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
And Detroit was definitely, I feel like Detroit is definitely a place in America that helped start the punk movement.
Yeah.
I mean, with the MC5, that band was, they're very important. They're from Detroit.
Yeah, okay.
Very important band. And Iggy and the Stooges, same thing, very important band, came from Detroit, and death were influenced by those bands.
Locals.
The local bands. Yeah.
Right.
So, I didn't learn about that Detroit part of the puzzle until much later. So that made so much sense when we heard death and we were able to be like, yes, this is similar to MC5 and the Stooges and early Ramones and just stuff like that. So, I don't know. Because there's different types of punk.
That's true. Yeah.
There's the Mohawk, spiky Mohawk punk.
Yeah.
Me and my brothers call it Dookie Punk. I don't know why. And then, then there's I feel like the proto punk is it's kind of punk for scholars, scholarly punk. It's the stuff that's it laid down the foundation for all the punk that we know now.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't at the time they probably just called it rock and roll.
Yeah.
Because I don't think, Iggy, he was born a punk, but. That wasn't really a term until the late 70s. And I heard that if you called anybody a punk back then, in the early 70s, that was fighting words.
Yeah.
So those dudes were just trying to be a rock, outlandish rock and roll band. They were just we want to be very out there and crazy and rock and roll. But some of those dudes didn't have as much talent as Peter Frampton or something.
Right. Well, if you took... Yeah.
So they're punk because they can't really play that well.
At the same time, if you listen to Nevermind the Bollocks, the Sex Pistols, if you took away the vocals, if you took pull down Johnny Rotten from the mix and just listen to the music, you'd think, well, it's rock and roll. Just yeah. amped up a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, it's like got the catchy, you know, Steve Jones was laying down the catchy
riffs. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it's pretty catchy.
And there's a solid backbeat, and then you bring in Johnny Rotten, and he's like, God Save the Queen, and, yeah. you know, Bodies, which is, yeah. you know, a really nasty, a rough song. I shouldn't say yeah. nasty, but it's a rough song.
Yeah, so there's so many different areas of punk. There's so many different corners. It's like a labyrinth. Like, punk yeah. is like, the term is like such a big umbrella. It's kind of like rock now, because I feel like mm-hmm. there's so many different types of rock.
Yeah, I mean, rock doesn't, it's almost like the word doesn't even mean anything.
Exactly, and I think punk is starting to get like that too, because there's so many different types of punk.
Yeah.
And I feel like where death falls, it's in that proto-punk area where it's, They wanted to be rock and roll. Like, back then, it's like, we are a rock and roll band.
Yeah.
But they're just extra hard and extra loud and a little more, like, edgy. Mm-hmm. And that's what punk became later on.
Oh, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where do you see you guys fitting into that scope? Or what tradition are you, do you think you're kind of?
I mean, I feel like we'd like to think that we're in that same tradition. Like, we always joke around about our sound, because sometimes mm-hmm. like for certain audiences we're too rock for punk and right. then we're too punk for rock, so like we like to stay in that middle area where like we could go either way, like people could either call us a punk band or yeah. a rock band.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. And this, the new album, just kind of continues that same, you know, that same philosophy.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, so I was asking you about the unique opportunity you guys have as an primarily African-American yeah. band. How is your message and your presentation received? Because you guys have played around up and down the coast. And mm-hmm. how, I mean, I think about, well, it's kind of a two-part question. You know, there's coming to terms with it in Burlington, Vermont, which is, just statistically speaking, a very white kind of mm-hmm. place.
And it's yeah, we play to a lot of white people.
Yeah, yeah, okay. I don't think I'm out of bounds saying
no,
that.
No, no,
right?
Yeah, you're not out of bounds at all.
Yeah, yeah. But then you guys go down the coast, and as you go down the coast, you probably play to all different kinds of audiences, much different kind of audiences.
Well, it's our audiences are primarily white, because like this, the scene that we're in, it's like primarily white bands and white promoters and white fans. Every now and again, we do get a lot of, we'll get people that come to our shows that are a lot like us, like, you know, people of color or like whatever coming and mm-hmm. like, it's like, yeah, thank you for doing this. You know, like, I'm the only person of color in this scene, and it's really nice to see you guys.
Yeah.
Like, I'm glad you guys are a band, because, you know, it gives me, you know, hope that there'll be more diversity at shows like this, because, you know, I like punk and I like rock, and
yeah.
you know, there's not a lot of kids who look like me who like this kind of music, but I love this kind of music, and it's, you know, I'm happy that you're here. So we get right. that a lot, which is really nice, because we're those kids too. Like, when we go, we're like, oh man, cool, like, you know, like, I've always been the only black person at a punk show, and I'm just used to it. But like, it is nice to yeah. like see other bands and other scenes that
yeah
that
And as angry and, you know, as confrontational as punk is by its nature and, you know, by reputation, you guys are very accepted and very, like, very much a part of any scene that you go into. It's like, yeah, yeah. okay, let's see what these guys from Vermont bring.
Sure, yeah. And it's just, like, interesting. It's like, a band that looks like us from Vermont. It's interesting.
Yeah, it takes people
very
a minute.
Very interesting, because people, when yeah. they think of Vermont, they think of Ben & Jerry's, they think of Phish.
Right.
So it's like a primarily African-American punk band from Vermont.
Yeah.
It's just interesting. So people are like, what is this all about? You know?
Yeah. There have been times when I've, you know, played out of town, or, you know, we've had a gig, you know, in another part of the country. And it's like, yeah, so are you guys a jam band? It's
exactly. Like, yeah. No. Yeah. No. I mean, we get that too. Like, people are like, yeah, you play fusion jazz, reggae, jam. It's like, nope. Like, that actually happened to us once.
How do you? Yeah. Tell me about that.
Like, oh, yeah. It was hilarious. That? So we were like bringing our stuff in to a venue, getting yeah. set up, and there was these dudes playing darts or something at the place. Like, yeah, well, you guys play funk? And I was like, yeah. And they stuck around.
Yeah, you just tell them what
yeah,
they want to hear.
Yeah, I told them, I was like, yep, we play whatever you want us, whatever you think we play, that's what we play.
Yeah.
And they stuck around, you know, for a little bit, and we Yeah. As soon as we fired up those instruments, those dudes were out. They ran. They like literally ran out of the place because nice. We were so loud. They were not expecting us to sound like like to be a punk band.
Must be fun to go against expectation that.
That's like my favorite thing.
Yeah.
So I love it. Love it.
Love it. Cool. So looking toward the future with the new album and about to come out. When's the proper, I guess, CD and download?
So this is the way we're doing it right now. The vinyl is available on pre-order right now, and locally it's in. You can find it locally in a couple shops.
Mm-hmm.
But we're gonna do our official release date is Friday, August 10th, 2018, mm-hmm. and that's when it will be available on digitally.
Right.
For the whole universe.
Nice.
Yeah. So, nice. Yeah. That's and the day.
Yeah. So, I guess we can break the news. So, Steve is moving out of town.
Yeah. Steve is leaving us.
Yeah. That was sad for me on a couple accounts.
Yeah.
So, he's moving out to the Pacific Northwest. Yep. And is there anything you can tell us about any plans as far as playing out or what the plan is with a new?
We're handling the situation internally, as most companies say. So yeah. Don't worry. We have a few options and we're on it because we have a local show in August at Higher Ground, August mm-hmm. 11th. So we will have a body hopefully, and someone playing the bass.
Yeah.
And then, we're just going to go from there. And we also hope to have one last hurrah with Steve out in the Pacific Northwest, because we actually have been trying to tour out that way for a long time, ever since we started as a band.
Mm-hmm.
We actually got most of our support from the Pacific Northwest. Like, some of the first people to, be interested in Rough Francis outside of Burlington were people from Vancouver, people from Seattle, people from Portland.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Why do you suppose?
I do not know. I really don't know why, but,
a Vancouver.
Yeah. I remember when our first album came out, I was sending a lot of records to Vancouver, Seattle, and Portland.
Yeah. I mean, Seattle I kind of get. Traditionally, it's you definitely fall into that sound.
So, seems like we have some people out there. So Steve moving out to that part of the country is actually really convenient for us, because we can go visit him, check up on him, and force him to play some shows with us over there.
He'll need that.
He'll need it. So yeah. I was like, yep, just make sure you save up a couple, it'll just be a mini tour, probably a 4 or 5 day tour.
Nice.
It's take those days off from work and just hang out with us, just old times, and we'll do that. And then after that, then we'll figure out a more permanent situation for the band. But we got it. We got it under control.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's worried.
Yeah.
They're just eager to know what's going on.
Yeah.
You tell me about from the beginning, you talked about growing up around Lamb's Bread mm-hmm. and the influence that had on you kind of picking up the instruments. What were some of the first things when you were getting started that you were doing musically, singing, drumming, or where did it start for you?
Well, I first became interested in playing the drums, and a big reason why that happened was Lamb's Bread used to practice in the house. They didn't have a studio space yet.
Yeah,
because my dad and uncle built. They turned the garage into a practice space and a recording studio. But before that, they would practice in the house. So. Mm. After their practice was done, the guitar player and my dad would put their bass, their guitars away.
Yeah.
But the only thing that was left was the drums, because they were just set up. And, the sticks were around. So that was the most accessible thing mm-hmm. at the time. And that's how I got into playing drums.
Because they were there.
They were there.
Yeah. And they're drums.
And they're fun. You're a six-year-old kid, there's nothing better than banging on a bunch of drums.
Yeah, that was
making your mom mad.
Yeah. So many good reasons to take up drums,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. But then I just started playing, and my uncle taught me a few beats, and I got really into it and really serious about learning how to play beats, because I realized if I played a beat, people would dance. So I was I'll just do this. And you know, if people are dancing and happy that I'm playing drums and they won't tell me to get off the drums.
Yep.
Because usually...
And your mom can't yell at you.
Yeah, when you sound terrible, people want you off the drum sets. But if you sound good, people will let you stay on there and you can play longer. So that's how I like get into it, and that's how I learned. It's like, okay, if I'm just like good, people will let me stay and I can continue to stay on the drum set because I loved it so much.
So when did you start putting bands together?
I started putting bands together when I was in eighth grade.
Oh, wow.
Yeah
nice and early.
Yeah, it was funny because it just happened. It's like, oh, like I know a kid who has a bass. It's like, cool, he can be in the band. It's like, I know a kid who has a guitar. He can be in the band.
Not and plays guitar or plays bass. Yeah,
if you have the thing, you're already in the band.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, you know, I can play drums and... we started a band. Me and my friends started a band, and it was really funny. We'd play during lunch at school, and we'd play.
And that was around here, though, right?
Yeah, it was in Jericho. I went to Browns River Middle School.
Okay,
so like we were the coolest thing at Browns River Middle School.
Was there much competition for that title?
Oh no, there was no competition at all because there's no other bands because we were the ones with the instruments and like we could actually like play them a little bit. So we do like these terrible Nirvana covers and we like cover all like we did like a lot of instrumental covers, but we were so cool because every time we were done playing like at lunch or during like a block period. People would just scream, like the girls up front, the girls would be up front and they would just scream. And we felt like we were the Beatles because they'd be like, ah! After we're done. And, you know, and then all the teachers would get mad. Like we felt like such rebels because like the teachers were like, can you turn it down? And girls are screaming and we were just excited.
That's the dream.
It was the dream. It was pretty.
You were living the dream.
It was awesome.
In Jericho, Vermont.
It was awesome. Like we'd be so excited for these school shows, you know. And it's hilarious because, you know, we're bringing gear in and, you know, we're playing like we made a deal with like our vice principal or whoever like helped us put it together. It's like, okay, you guys can play lunch period A and B, take a break on the C, and then you can go back on the D.
So you had a manager.
Yeah, we had a manager, and I don't even think we got paid, but I feel like we got like some maybe like free lunches or something from like the, I don't know, like something we got from the lunchroom.
Right.
Like, you know, for playing.
Extra tots.
Yeah, extra tots. No, seriously, it was totally along those lines, like extra tots.
Nice. Hey, these guys are in the band. You want to set them up. You
gotta go. It was great. It was
the
so
drummer
much
needs his carbs.
Yeah, it was so much fun. Oh. And like a lot of the other teachers loved it too. But there was this one teacher that hated it. And she was so mad that we would play, you know, disturb her class. And she like was so mad. And all the other teachers were like, come on, like just relax a little. And she's like, I'm going to go to the principal's office and get to put a stop to this. And it's almost felt like, so bad.
It's almost like a classic like 70s, 80s you know, school movie where you got the one teacher who's just ridiculously cartoonishly angry.
Yeah, we felt bad, man. We're like, yeah, we're so cool.
which just encouraged you.
Oh, yeah. I was like, this is what I want to do for the rest of my life.
Yeah, is make the grown-ups angry.
And here I am.
Yeah. So then after school, if you know, what did you go on to do? Did you move into the big city of Burlington and or where did you go from there?
After high school, during high school, I was in a punk hardcore band called Common Ground. And that was like the first band I was in that I was like really proud of and really like we were like, you know, young and we just wanted to save the world with our punk music. And we went on tour. I went on my first tour when I was like 17 years old.
Right, so you're still in high school?
Yeah, or like it was after high school, but I was like, 17, 18.
Sure.
And that was like a really interesting experience. And like, you know, I made some really awesome friends that I still know now. And like, that was like a cool time to like learn how to be in a functional band on the road. And then I just like continued to do things like that. I was just like in one band, and then once that band broke up, I just get into another one and do the same things. Like, we're gonna go on tour and save the world. We're gonna go on tour and save the world. We're gonna go on tour and make a lot of money. We're gonna go, you know, it's like, it just,
oh boy,
yeah. And then it's like, oh yeah, exactly.
Oh,
it's
boy.
Like, yeah, we're gonna do this, we're gonna do that. And then the reality of it is like, okay, like, you know, show up to a venue and there's like nobody there. Like even the sound man didn't show up. Like, you know, we're like in the middle, like Wichita, Kansas. It's like, oh, there's a show tonight. You guys are playing? Cool. Yeah, the sound man's not coming.
Oh, man. And this is like your first experiences. Yeah. You actually went out to Kansas.
Oh, I've been all over the place. Yeah. There's this band that I used to be in that you might remember called the Static Age.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, we've had this discussion before.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. We did some extensive touring, and that...
You guys went around a lot those first few years.
Yeah, we were out a lot. And
that's right. We shared a bill.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay. That was like our... I think my band's
Mailbox.
First. Yeah, Mailbox's first... Or second gig.
Yeah. Yeah. You guys play. We played.
I always forget that. It was Battery Street Jeans.
Battery Street Jeans.
When it was on Battery Street.
Yep.
It was on the second floor. They called it the Space.
Yep. Yep.
At Battery Street.
And you guys covered Big Shot by Billy Joel.
Yeah. That's how we closed. Because we were hip.
Yeah.
We were.
I thought you guys were great. Yeah. And we actually bought a keyboard from you too. Static Age.
That's right. That's right.
DX7?
It was a DW8000.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. But it was that same, because your keyboard, I can't remember
Marie.
Her
name.
Marie, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, she had the same one, and I was trying to sell it, and I thought, well, maybe she's looking for a backup or a replacement. And
yeah, I remember like going to your house before we were like going on a tour. Like, we had to get this keyboard before we left. It's like, yeah, we got to get this keyboard.
That's right.
Loud, and we were like so ready, and like we didn't even test it out. We like brought it out on the road. It's like, okay, this thing better work.
Yep. That's so funny. My memory is just like, just filled in things incorrectly. Because I remember Marie came over for the keyboard, but I guess I thought it was...
Because we were waiting. I remember waiting in the van for it. Like, we were like, you lived at, did you live like... In the new old North End?
I think I lived at the top of Rose Street.
Yep, I remember the van parked out on Rose Street, and they ran up to get the keyboard.
Oh, that's brilliant. Yeah. So that's right. So you were in a Static Age. I didn't even write that. That's so funny. I was like, I knew it. And then it just, you know, because that was literally 18. No, it was 2002.
Yeah.
2003, maybe.
Yeah, 2002,
so it was a while
probably,
ago.
Because that was when Marie was still in the band.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what was that like? Because that was more like you guys were kind of doing like a new wave, not goth, but like new wave psychedelic
post-punk.
Yeah, kind of thing.
Yeah, that was the band that like we did some really big things. And the thing that sucked was at the time, like when we were like starting to get out there, there were a bunch of other bands that were already like really successful, like that band Interpol and... Mm-hmm. There was a few other bands that did the same style, and like the Killers were still. I don't think the Killers were like big quite yet, but they were about to be huge.
Yeah,
I remember
that
seeing,
wave of like reinventing the '80s.
Yeah,
right around
like
that
it was
same
like
time.
The start. But like all those bands have been, they were chosen. Those bands were chosen and ready to make millions of dollars.
Yeah,
so I remember seeing the Killers at Metronome. There's only 30 people there. I saw them at Metrodome with 30 people, and then like a month later, they're like the biggest band in the world. So it was like that kind of stuff was happening.
Yep.
That was back when like record labels were still like, you know, kind of picking and choosing who was going to be huge.
It was still record companies.
Yeah,
to,
yeah.
To
so like
with.
We thought we were going to be put in that mix somehow. Like it's like, yeah, we'll get discovered by somebody, and like we'll be just as successful as these bands. But like little did we know that like all those bands were already selected and being, you know, released, like slowly fed to the masses.
Yeah, I mean, you guys had the goods. There was no
we
doubt.
We did have
about
the goods, man.
Yeah.
We had the goods.
It's just timing and.
Yeah, we had the
who you
turmoil. We had the goods. Like, it was like we were a really interesting band from Burlington and we were out there. But I feel like we didn't play to the right crowds at that time.
Yeah.
We got some cool opportunities. Like, we went on tour with some really big bands.
Mm-hmm.
And
did
we were
you
like.
Have some good opening slots?
Yeah, yeah. Like, we went out on tour with this band, AFI. They're like a goth punk band from California. They're really big. They got really big, and we were like lucky enough to be an opener for their tour. It was a good fit, but like I felt like we at the time we weren't playing the right audiences, and you know. But it was a lot of fun, and I met a lot of awesome people, and you know, it was like some of the best memories that.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm thinking about like some of the bands that I've been in, even cover bands or original bands. It's like you get that little plateau.
Yeah.
You know, you go up a little, maybe you get a second plateau, and then you just, you know, you can't if you get too concerned about what could be next or what you could get or what's now within reach or just out of reach, and if you get too hung up on that, then you'll lose sight of, you know, this moment that you're in, which you know, even, you know, 50 people, 500 people, 5,000, you know, you can enjoy it all.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah. I feel like that's kind of like what happens. It's like all the things I've been involved with when I was in it, never really enjoyed it the way I should have. And then you look back and like, wow, that was so cool. Like, I should have enjoyed that more.
Yeah, kind of savor that. I've had, you know, I played a show, like the biggest show my current band ever played was in front of 800 people. That was like our,
oh, wow,
our one, you That's know, awesome. Big, yeah, it was a great show. It was at a festival and, you know, it was really exciting, but it was the first time we played in front of anyone more than like 50.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, so we went from like playing Monkey House and Nectars to this theater for this, you know, festival. And That's it was awesome. Just like, it was awesome, but it was overwhelming.
Yeah.
It's like I couldn't even, you know, and I made a mental note to myself before we went on stage. It was like, no matter how much of a whirlwind it is, or no matter how crazy, at some point in the set, just stop for 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And look. Yeah. You know, at everyone just sitting in their seats looking at you.
Yeah.
Just, you know,
yeah.
you don't have to be egotistical, just like take a moment.
Take a moment. You know, like, yeah, because like with Rough Francis, whenever we play, and like we're really grateful because we do get like a good response and people actually show up, and I'm always grateful for all the people that come to support us.
Yeah.
You know, because it takes a lot to come out to a show, you know.
It does.
It takes a lot of effort.
It does, and it doesn't get easier.
No. Yeah. So it's like I really appreciate people who come to shows.
Yeah.
You know.
That's great. And then so you did the Static Age.
Yeah.
And then what happened after that, or how did that, you know,
transpire? Well, I had to leave the band because that was around the time when my first child was about to be born.
Mm.
So I had to leave the band just because of I was going to be a father.
Mm-hmm.
And once I left the band, they got a fill-in. It was kind of like the Steve situation. Like,
yeah.
I was like the Steve for a little bit. And, you know, I was at home and, like, I was, you know, kind of getting into a new phase of life with being a father. And lo and behold, right when I'm, like, hanging out and being a dad and doing all that stuff, I thought I wasn't going to be, like, doing music or being in a band or touring around again. That's when the death thing comes along.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, shoot.
Yeah, then, you got to answer the call.
And then I answered the call and got right back into it. Yeah.
So how does it being a punk rockin' dad?
It's awesome. I love
yeah.
it.
Yeah. And you have two kids, is that
I
right?
I have two children, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And have they come out to see you yet?
They know about the band. They've seen videos. They've seen me perform live. And yeah, they think it's hilarious that I, like, yell, you know,
yeah.
scream.
Yeah, just like you do with them, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. Actually, I don't really scream at them
the
way
kidding.
I do on stage, but, like,
I would hope
like,
not.
I feel like, you know, they know how loud I can scream, so they try not to. Yeah,
yeah.
They're like, nope.
No. I don't want my dad to get all punk rock on
exactly,
me.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So I'm actually very quiet. I'm like, put your stuff away.
Yeah. Oh, when he starts whispering, that's when you got to worry.
I know, yeah, exactly.
Sweet. So you're also playing with a few other bands. So you have your kids, you get back into death. I mean, you get back into Rough Francis.
Yes.
And then you're still taking on, you took on some other projects that you play around with.
Why not?
So who else are you playing around with? And you're back behind the kit.
I'm back behind the kit, man.
Nice.
Just to let you know, like between the time that, you know, I started becoming a dad and Rough Francis, or like once Rough Francis started, I reconnected with my Static Age pals, and I actually ended up playing a few shows with those guys.
Oh,
they came up to Burlington because they're based out of Chicago now. They're still an active band, or they go to Europe now a lot, which is really cool for them. But I remember there was a Static Age Rough Francis show that happened. Which was really funny. And I ended up playing drums for some of that.
Well, you talk
and
about...
That was like a party. Yeah,
you talk about like monkeys and Jimi Hendrix, right?
Yeah, exactly. And like, you know, there's been some wacky configurations of like all my old bands coming back because like, you know, all of us are older and we want to hang again. But but for now, I'm playing drums in this Peruvian garage rock outfit called Espero Psychos. And that's me, Julian, and Paul from Rough Francis, our friend Mitchell, and our other friend Adam Lyon Rodriguez,
Yep.
Yep. And that's a really fun group to be in. And I
Peruvian?
Yeah, Peruvian garage rock. It's actually a tribute to this band called Los Psychos.
Yeah.
And it's like similar. They're pretty much like the Peruvian death. They were like this band from the early 60s that had this really harsh punk sound, but punk wasn't a thing yet. So they were just like a regular rock band that just sounded really crazy. And people probably hated them, but then, you know,
time came around
and like they became these legends. Mm-hmm. So, and we heard the record and we were like, oh my God, this is so cool. We should do this. And we did it.
Yeah.
And now like we're just like this band and people don't really know who they are, but we do. And we're like,
well, if the music is good, it doesn't matter what the story is.
Yeah. And we love playing it and we do really well in Burlington. And then I also play surf drums for Barbacoa.
Oh yeah. And I think I've seen you guys once
or twice. Bill Mullins. Do you know Bill Mullins? That's his baby.
Yeah, and you're back on drums for that. And who else is in that band?
Kirk Flanagan. And he's another person that's an old Burlington punk. He used to be in that band Screaming Broccoli in the 80s.
Yeah. That was before my time. I didn't move here till the late 90s.
Yeah, yeah. So like a lot of these dudes have been in like cool punk bands in the 80s, like Burlington punk bands.
So a lot of the people that you're playing with, are they our age?
Some of them are, and then some of them are a little younger, but yeah, like generally, you know, in the same age bracket. Yeah.
That's very cool because, I mean, all the people in my band, they're, you know, my age are actually older.
Yeah.
And it's so cool to see, you know, you think about punk rock as being this very young thing, but it doesn't really go away. It doesn't need to go away.
Yeah.
It's aged better than anyone would have thought.
Yeah, totally. I have a joke about punk now because I feel like punk is like older, like all the punks are older now, and it's like the new dad rock.
Not so much with the Billy Joel covers.
Yeah, it's gonna be like, it's like, oh, the Clash and Sex Pistols, that's dad rock.
Oh man. Well, if Joe Strummer wasn't dead yet, right?
Yeah,
that would kill him.
Oh yeah, it's funny. It's really funny.
Yeah. That's great. I mean, the stuff I play is like progressive rock, so it's like by its nature just old, you know.
Totally.
It's the, you know, it's the 50s and up.
Punk is getting there too.
Yeah,
like, punk is in the same. It's gonna be like, you know,
yeah, they're
people with gray hair are gonna be playing Damned tunes. It's like, yep, that's dad rock. Their kids are like, oh my God, he's playing Richard Hell again. Oh God.
Yeah. back before vinyl became cool again.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what at the end of every episode, I like to close out by asking my guest four questions. All right. And I think you looked them over.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll start with four questions about what they love about Vermont. And so we'll start with your favorite Vermont place.
I mean, I have a lot of favorite Vermont places, but, you know, I really like Montpelier. Downtown Montpelier is so nice. It's such a Vermont-y. It just looks like a postcard, a Vermont postcard.
Yeah.
And I just love like strolling downtown. And
I mean, if you look down the main street and there's is the hardware store even there anymore?
But yeah. It's, yeah.
Yeah. And it's, it, yeah.
And I love little towns that have like, you know, like the little comic book towns where there's like one of everything.
You know? Right. There is. There totally is just
it's
one
like
of
the
everything.
Coffee shop, the pizza place, the post office.
Well, have you guys played, what's the club, the pizza place?
Positive Pie.
Positive Pie.
We played there a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was interesting because felt like that place was too nice for us.
Possibly.
Yeah, it's just too nice.
Yeah, so I guess you guys never played the Black Door when that was open.
No, we didn't play that place.
What is there? Where is there to play?
Charlie O's. We've played
that's
there.
That's right, that's right.
And
I've played a few
college.
Gigs there. Yeah.
We played the college.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we love Montpelier. And people seem to love Ruff Francis down there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I just love visiting Montpelier.
Yeah.
Such a nice joint.
Yeah, Charlie O's is a fun gig. I've played a few gigs there once with once or twice with Hot Neon Magic doing 80s covers.
Nice.
And you never know. And then we played a few times, several times, I should say, at Black Door. And it's always cool, the Central Vermonters, because you think, oh, it's going to be, you know, a bunch of fish heads.
Yeah.
You know, nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, nothing wrong with it.
But then you show up and they're just crazy about the stuff that you would not expect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they'll come out and they'll go crazy over the 80s stuff, or they'll come out and go crazy over, you know, the surf rock or or the punk rock.
Yeah. Now, there's a lot of punks in Montpelier.
Yeah, very cool.
Yeah.
As rural as it is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They're everywhere. We're everywhere.
Yeah.
Your favorite Vermont memory?
Actually, my favorite Vermont memory is actually memories of the Reggae Fest. When my dad was in Lambsbread, he put together this huge festival that ran for a while, like every summer. And that was like my favorite thing because, you know, I was like pretty young. I was a kid, probably like 9 or something. And, you know, we come to Burlington, like the thing would be in Burlington. And it was just so much fun because I was like able to just like roam around. That was back when people didn't really care about children. Like, the children could just go anywhere. Like I was like able, I remember just exploring like downtown and not they did a reggae fest at Oakledge Park. Believe it or not, a huge, I can't remember how many people showed up, but it was like thousands of people showed up to Oakledge Park for this reggae fest because the fest was free. Oh. And thousands of people show up and it was just like a free for all. Like, it was crazy. And like, it was just the best people watching and the best time in Burlington because it was like reggae was just like kind of like a new thing. This new sound that came, you know, like it was like, whoa, reggae is so cool.
That's true. It was like, you got to give it some perspective.
Back
in the 80s and 90s, it was, in Vermont, you know, you got to add 10 years whenever you involve Vermont.
So all these like reggae superstars would be coming to Vermont.
Yeah.
And it was just like a huge party. And I remember just like, it was like such a fun time. But I think that was my favorite Vermont memory because it was like, you know, conceived in Vermont. Like this was like a thing that, my dad and a small group of his friends put together.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was a pretty, it was like an institution for a while.
Yeah. How many years did that run? When did that run?
It ran for probably like a good, I want to say like 8 years.
Yeah.
Something like that.
That's a solid run.
Yeah.
Nice.
I could be wrong. Don't quote me at that. You can look on the internet if
that's
fine. You really need to.
Yeah. We're not holding you to anything.
Yeah. I remember those days back before the internet, like you could just like make up lies and people wouldn't fact check you.
I have sad news for you, Bobby.
What?
They still do that. Because they are counting on most people not looking up the facts.
It's like, I could say anything and they'll just believe me.
Yeah. I'm not talking about anyone in particular, am I?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Tell me about, we're going to keep it light, keeping it light.
All right.
Tell me about your favorite Vermont food or drink. And or drink. You can.
My favorite Vermont food and drink. Well, I really like Vermont brewskis.
Yeah.
I'm actually trying
Which one? Which one? Which? What's your favorite Vermont beer?
I was really into. There's a lot of them. I got to think for a second here.
What was the last one you really enjoyed?
Actually, my favorite Vermont beer. You're gonna laugh because it's like it's a seasonal Christmas beer. It's the Winter Warmer by Harpoon.
Winter Warmer? Is Harpoon Vermont?
Yep, it's Windsor, Vermont, and Boston.
Okay.
So it's
okay. I knew it was Boston. I didn't realize they also
Windsor,
had
Vermont.
Okay.
So that I really like that because it has nutmeg and cinnamon. I like wacky beer for Christmas.
That's do you put a little umbrella or like a little candy cane?
No,
in it
I don't
when
do
drink
that.
It?
But like, it's just like a nice beer for winter time. But
yeah,
I also like.
Into the ciders?
I'm into the ciders. I like Citizen Cider a lot.
Yeah.
I like the Dirty Mare.
Yes.
That's a good one. That's standard.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's another cider company. Shaxberry's really good. That cider's good.
I'll have to try that out.
Yeah. And then there's the Stowe Cider.
Yes.
The High and Dry.
Yeah.
That's the best, the high and dry.
It's what's it called? Yeah, Stowe. I forget the specific one that they do, but they have
And there's
some
another
stunners.
One called Gin and Juice. That's really good. I know, Gin and Juice. But it's really good.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. That's fine. I'll have to look out for that one.
Yeah.
All right, and then the fourth question is, and I don't know if you've had time to figure this one out yet, but who is your favorite Vermonter?
My favorite Vermonter. And it took me a long time because I wanted to pick someone who's like, you know, like an underdog, someone who's underappreciated. And I think I'm going to, My pick is my favorite cashier at Hannaford. Her name is Janet. You might know her.
I possibly. I mean, North Ave, right?
Yeah. But she's great. She's just a really kind-hearted person. She's like, you know, like always like joke around with her and like, but you know, sometimes like I'll ask her how she's doing and she'll tell you, she won't lie. She'll, if she's not doing well, she'll tell you.
That's, if she's Vermont. Doing well.
Yeah.
That's what I love about
her. And that's what I respect about her is like, she's really honest and like, you know, if you ask her how she's doing, she'll tell you how she's doing.
Nice.
And I really appreciate that.
That's a great thing. I forget if it was on this show or if it was just with someone else recently. We were talking about the difference between, you know, North and South.
Yeah.
And, you know, and some people, some Southerners will say, boy, the folks up in Northern New England, they're just so rude.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, they're just not going to, you know, blow hot air on you.
Yeah.
You know, they're just not going to lie to you.
Yeah.
And that's a great thing about where we live.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's Janet. I picked Janet.
All right. That's great. That's the best answer. That's real. Keeping it real.
Yep.
Awesome. So how can people find you and what you're working on online, the different projects you got going on?
Different projects. Probably like Facebook and stuff.
Yeah. Rough Francis. Barbacoa.
And Psychos are on Instagram.
Oh, okay.
Rough Francis is on Instagram and Facebook. Barbacoa is on Facebook. And we also have a website. Ruff Francis has a website that looks like it was made in the 90s. We're trying to be like really hip right now.
By hip and retro?
Yeah.
By having a 90s style website?
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, all right. Yeah. Is it hosted by AOL?
No, it's not hosted by AOL. But no. Like,
see, that would be hardcore.
Yeah, that would be pretty hardcore.
All right. I've been talking with Bobby Hackney Jr. today. He is the lead singer of Ruff Francis and the other bands that we've been discussing. Thank you for chatting today. Thanks for coming in. And you can follow Vermont Favorites on Facebook to find out about upcoming guests. And you can subscribe to the podcast and catch up on any episodes you may have missed at imadeitup.com. Vermont Favorites is a production of WBTV LP 99.3 FM Burlington, online at 993wbtv.org. I'm Adam Rabin. Thank you for listening. Take care.